Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Updates. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear what Hoosier politicians are saying about the zero tolerance policy and family separation at the border. Sharon Jackson talks to Christian Jurgensen about his Republican Party win for the 7th District seat. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Mark McGill of the Jesse Brown Veterans Administration Health Center about suicide prevention. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Updates. The contingent of 12 mayors from the U.S. Conference of Mayors was turned away by representatives from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The Post-Tribune reports the mayors traveled to the Texas border town about 20 miles from El Paso to draw attention to what they called a humanitarian crisis caused by the government when it carried out President Donald Trump's order to separate immigrant parents from their children as they tried to enter the country illegally. Of the HH workers at the gate, Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson said, "We talked to them about why we were there, and they gave us a story that it will take 3 weeks to process us." She goes on to say the delegation couldn't see any of the children and didn't speak to family members of the children who were separated from their parents or guardians as part of Trump's zero-tolerance immigration policy that he reversed on Wednesday. The mayors held a press conference after their journey to port of entry, and each one spoke to a small crowd of reporters. Freeman Wilson said, quote, "A reporter asked me how people in Gary connect with us. I said, injustice anywhere is injustice in Gary. This is a total disregard for human beings. But there's something about children that really underscores the need for us to be better as a people." Freeman Wilson described the mayor's contingent as a bipartisan one made up of Democrats and Republicans. They were led by Columbia, South Carolina Mayor Steve Benjamin, who's president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. Freeman Wilson criticized Trump for signing an executive order separating families and then reversing it. She says, quote, "Why would you do this in the first place?" Freeman Wilson called Gary a city built by immigrants from more than 50 countries who wanted to relocate here. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Demolition has begun on a 3,400-seat theater in Northwest Indiana that has hosted Bob Dylan, Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, and other entertainers over nearly four decades. The Times reports contractor Environmental Cleansing Corp is tearing apart the Star Plaza Theater at the intersection of I-65 and U.S. 30 in Maryville. Star Plaza was one of the largest indoor theaters in Indiana and the greater Chicago metropolitan area. The Oak Ridge Boys were the final act to perform there in the theater. Spokeswoman Kathleen Sebastian of White Lodging says the demolition should take about 3 months. White Lodging plans to redevelop the property with a new hotel, restaurants, and green space. The Maryville-based hotel developer already has raised the Radisson Star Plaza. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The remains of a soldier from Gary who was captured and killed during the Korean War have been identified. The remains of Army Private First Class David Baker will be buried Saturday at Evergreen Memorial Park in Hobart. Baker was 18 years old when he went missing in action in November 1950. The Times reports the Defense Department used DNA analysis to identify the remains. They were included in 34 boxes of remains sent to the Central Identification Laboratory in Hawaii. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The son of a former Calumet Township trustee has received no additional jail time for his role in his mother's federal public corruption case. 52-year-old Stephen Hunter of Chicago apologized Tuesday in federal court in Hammond. He was sentenced to a year of supervised release and ordered to pay restitution to the Calumet Township trustee's office. He's already served 5 months in jail. Ex-trustee Mary Elgin was sentenced in May to just over a year in prison for forcing her employees to donate time and money to her re-election campaigns. She and her son pleaded guilty to conspiracy and fraud charges. Elgin was trustee from 2003 until 2014. Federal prosecutors in 2014 charged Elgin and three others, including Hunter, who had led the township's Information Systems and Technology Office. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana's gas tax is set to increase again this year. It's a small hike after last year's 10-cent surge. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on why the state's fuel tax will go up a year after a major road funding bill took effect.
Lawmakers said the 2017 bill's 10-cent gas tax hike was to catch up after the state went nearly two decades without an increase. To avoid falling behind again, lawmakers also created automatic yearly increases tied roughly to inflation. They're capped at one penny a year. Scott Imus heads the trade group for many of Indiana's gas station owners. He says customers likely won't notice this year's hike.
But a tax is a tax. This is a tax that will never go down, that will be added up.
Ima says Hoosiers will pay more than 60 cents in state and federal taxes per gallon of gas they buy beginning next month. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The city of Gary is allowing the public to report certain crimes via the internet. The Times says the Gary Police Department's online feature should be used for non-emergency situations within the city limits. The citizens' online reporting system can be used to report battery, intimidation, lost property, telephone harassment, theft, threats, and vandalism. Reports filed through the online system will be reviewed to determine whether further investigation is needed. Police say 911 still should be used for emergencies. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A man is being honored for helping to subdue a motorist who was grappling with a police officer during a Northwest Indiana traffic stop. Police in Hammond released a screen grab from police dash cam video showing the June 1st struggle. Police officer Daniel Sangaratana stopped the SUV following reports a man had attempted to abduct girls, but the motorist got out and then started to reach under the SUV's driver's seat. Police say the officer grabbed him and they struggled for the officer's gun. 48-year-old Patrick Baum of Hammond was driving by, saw the officer in danger, and helped subdue the man until other officers arrived. Baum says he just ran in there and did what anyone should do. He was honored this week with an award for bravery. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The parents of a Portage woman who was fatally shot in 2011 have reached a settlement with an insurance company over damages in connection with the man convicted in her killing. The Times reports federal court records say American Family Mutual Insurance Company was in mediation with William and Sandra Bach and issues were resolved, quote, in a satisfactory manner. A judge dismissed the case last week and settlement details weren't released. The Bachs had sought money from Dustin McCowan and his father, Joseph Elliott McCowan. Dustin McCowan was sentenced in 2013 to 60 years in prison in the fatal shooting of his 19-year-old ex-girlfriend, Amanda Bach, of Portage. Her parents' lawsuit had said Joseph McCowan, a Crown Point police officer, didn't properly secure his firearms. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Residents in Northwest Indiana are urging officials to block a proposed $50 million waste processing and recycling facility. The Times reported residents, as well as environmentalists, asked the Little Calumet River Basin Commission last week to not renew a 2016 licensing agreement with Meyer Energy. The company failed to build the facility across the border in Chicago Heights. Gary residents expressed concerns about how the facility plan in the city would change the river's water quality. Meyer Energy said it would process up to 2,400 tons of waste at the 165,000-square-foot facility and employ more than 100 people. The Steel City Academy Charter School would be located next to the proposed facility. The school's principal, Katie Curley, said the students would be negatively impacted by the building. She goes on to say, "This will have massive implications for our school. Students, parents, and community leaders do not want to extend this lease to Maya." Brandon Dothager lives in Highland, which is 3 miles upriver from the project. He said the commission is designed to protect the floodplain and shouldn't let a company come to the river to import trash from Chicago. Dothager goes on to say, quote, "It's not servicing a local need. You can cancel the lease. Ultimately, you have the power over the land." Dan Repay, executive director of the commission, said the company could only build under the agreement if it gets a permit from the State Department of Environmental Management. The commission may take action on the agreement next month. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana Democrats' candidates for statewide office share a common theme. It's time for an end to one-party rule in Hoosier state government. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the messages delivered at the state Democratic Party convention Saturday.
Each member of the Democratic statewide ticket emphasized the need to eliminate Republican control at the state house, or as treasurer candidate John Aguilera put it,
I intend to get rid of the one-party rule and make America nice again.
Auditor candidate Jocelyn Whitaker says Democratic victories will help restore a balance of power.
The reason I need to be there right now, we don't have a watchdog.
Secretary of State candidate Jim Harper was the most specific. He says he'll use the office to advocate for changes in the Hoosier election system.
It's time for a Secretary of State who will fight back against this voter suppression agenda.
Each of the statewide candidates was unopposed at the convention. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The Democratic and Republican candidates in Indiana's Senate race say the U.S. should not separate parents from their children at the border. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports those candidates don't agree on who's to blame for that policy.
Incumbent Senator Joe Donnelly joined his fellow Democrats on a bill to end the Trump administration's family separation policy. The administration requires criminal prosecution of all who enter the country illegally. Children are taken from parents detained for criminal charges. Yet many argue some of those families are legally seeking asylum. The president says his administration has no choice. Donnelly says that's not true.
President Bush didn't do this. President Obama didn't do this. This was a decision made by the administration.
In a statement, Republican Senate candidate Mike Braun says families shouldn't be separated, but he says Congress's inaction on immigration is to blame and that it's up to Congress to fix it. Braun did not say whether, if he were in the Senate now, he would join the Democrats' bill to end the policy. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana Republican Senator Todd Young announced he will co-sponsor Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz's family separation bill. Cruz's proposal would end the Trump administration policy that separates children from their parents detained at the border. In a statement, Young says, America can be a nation of laws while still being a nation of compassion. The Cruz bill goes beyond family separation. It would also require asylum cases to be heard within 14 days. Critics argue the short window will make it difficult for asylum seekers and the lawyers to effectively present a case. The bill would double the number of immigration judges, a plan President Trump recently called, quote, horrible. The Texas lawmakers' measure is broader than one presented by all 49 Democratic senators, including Indiana's Joe Donnelly. Their proposal simply ends the Trump administration policy. President Trump signed an executive order Wednesday afternoon to keep families detained at the border together. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Support from Hoosier Republican voters helped Joe Donnelly in 2012 when he was first elected to the U.S. Senate. Now, Donnelly hopes to again garner support from the other side as he announced Monday the formation of a new campaign effort. Several Republicans helped launch the group and praised Donnelly's bipartisan approach. Longtime Republican supporter Ann Emerson Wishart says she came to support Senator Donnelly because of her deep roots in Indiana conservatism.
The Republican Party today is not my father's Republican Party. It's not my grandfather's Republican Party or my great-grandfather's.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. South Bend's Pride Week 2018 wrapped up over the weekend with a downtown block party on Saturday. Mayor Pete Buttigieg and his partner Chasten Glessman made an appearance at the party after their wedding ceremony.
When I was younger, I would have thought that there was an either-or question of living as who you are or having a chance to be in public service. I'm not sure I did believe this day would come.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. state officials Tuesday touted the first business to use a new kind of apprenticeship, which offers both pay and college credit. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports on the Earn and Learn program.
Estimates suggest Indiana could need to fill 1 million jobs by 2028. Office of Work-Based Learning and Apprentice Executive Director Daryl Zeck says the Earn and Learn initiative is designed to allow small to mid-sized businesses to form their own apprenticeship programs.
As a state, we can offer multiple pathways to help businesses.
The first program at Kokomo's Stewart Healthcare Consultants will train certified nursing assistants in a nursing home setting. CEO Tony Stewart says his company's program is aimed at easing the state's high turnover rate for CNAs in nursing homes.
We're doing leadership development training, HR training, and plus we're teaching the staff how to adapt.
Stewart says he plans to begin the first class later this summer. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A lawsuit by 5 employees of Goodwill of Central and Southern Indiana says the organization failed to protect them from a man accused of recording bathroom videos at a suburban Indianapolis store. The Indianapolis Star reports the lawsuit Tuesday says Goodwill didn't use, quote, reasonable care in hiring Richie Lee Hodges. Prosecutors say the registered sex offender in 2012 was convicted of child pornography and voyeurism for using a hidden camera in a bathroom in Boone County. Goodwill spokeswoman Cindy Graham says the organization cooperated fully with the investigation and is reviewing employment policies and procedures. Police were called to the Goodwill store in Fishers in February after a worker found a hidden camera. Hodges faces charges including child pornography and voyeurism. Court records don't yet list an attorney for him. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. President Trump has overridden an Obama-era executive order meant to protect the oceans and Great Lakes. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, it focuses more on promoting industry.
Obama's executive order was written in response to the 2010 BP oil spill into the Gulf of Mexico. Not only is there no mention of the spill in the new policy, but it references the importance of oil and gas drilling. Molly Flanagan is the vice president of policy for the Alliance for the Great Lakes. She says there's a federal ban on oil and gas drilling in the Great Lakes. Still, Flanagan says this order, combined with Trump's efforts to roll back Great Lakes restoration funding, is cause for concern.
A focus on short-term gains on the economic side at the expense of long-term protection for the Great Lakes is really short-sighted.
The National Ocean Policy Coalition, an organization that works to develop policy favoring offshore industries, says Trump's executive order removes unnecessary burdens on businesses and reduces confusion about regulation on the water. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana's new graduation pathways will include college entrance exams as one gatekeeper to graduation for some students. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports the U.S. Department of Education says that means schools must take extra care to follow student data privacy laws.
The state includes the SAT and ACT as options for students to complete the new graduation pathways. The tests include voluntary surveys around things like student interests and college plans. Then colleges and scholarship groups receive that data. But the U.S. Department of Ed is warning schools to be careful. IU professor Beth Kate says it's because once schools partner with vendors to offer the tests to students, a patchwork of federal privacy laws apply to both the schools and testing company.
Then they are regulated in the records that they can disclose and how they do that, and they have to make sure that they are adequately protecting privacy under the terms of those laws.
The new graduation pathway requirements start with the class of 2023. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana Right to Life leaders are calling for an investigation into Hoosier physicians who they claim are failing to report abortions performed on girls under the age of 16. As of last year, Indiana law requires doctors to report all abortions performed on girls 16 and under to the State Department of Health and the Department of Child Services within 3 days. Monica Siefker is the Bloomington representative for Right to Life. She says the law allows DCS to look into cases and is meant to protect the girls.
Given that as high as 1 in 4 girls may experience sexual abuse before they turn 18, it's likely that some of these pregnancies were not the result of consensual activity.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. A new federal lawsuit by healthcare and abortion providers is challenging the constitutionality of Indiana's abortion laws. The suit, filed Thursdays by organizations including the Whole Woman's Health Alliance, says the state's laws restrict a woman's access to abortions and single out providers. It says the laws have severely limited access to abortions. Whole Woman's Health Alliance wants to start a non-surgical abortion clinic in South Bend, but was denied a license. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill's office defends the state's laws against legal challenges. The Associated Press sent an email seeking comments Friday morning. A federal judge already is weighing whether to block a new Indiana law set to take effect July 1st about reporting complications arising from abortions. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Hoosiers who buy insurance on the marketplace established by the Affordable Care Act can expect higher premiums next year. The two insurance companies offering plans filed their 2019 rates this week. CareSource and Celtic have asked for the maximum increases allowed. Individual marketplace plans will increase by an average 5% overall. All Indiana counties will have plan options, but 13 counties will only have one marketplace option. Supporters for the ACA say Republicans' efforts to undermine the law have led to increased rates. Those opposed to the law say the higher rates prove the law isn't working. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Governor Eric Holcomb is praising a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that says states can force online shoppers to pay sales tax. The 5-4 decision Thursday overturns earlier rulings, which determined companies shipping products to states where they didn't have a physical presence weren't obligated to collect the state's sales tax. States have long complained that they were losing out on billions of dollars of revenue as a result. Indiana lawmakers anticipated federal legislation or a ruling like the one handed down Thursday. They approved a 2017 law that laid the groundwork for the state to collect online sales tax. Holcomb says he's taking a close look at the ruling to see how it will impact Indiana. Either way, he says it will level the playing field for retail stores. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Hoosiers can now plan to start paying sales tax for almost everything they buy online after the United States Supreme Court ruled such taxation legal. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports the economic boost for the state will likely continue to increase, with online sales unlikely to slow down.
Online purchases made in Indiana will be subject to the 7% sales tax up front. The state prepared for this day for over a year after passing legislation in 2017 to collect online sales tax from most businesses. Indiana Chamber Vice President Bill Waltz says the Supreme Court ruling is a big win for Indiana.
It's going to bring in probably somewhere in the range of 100, perhaps as high as 200 million in additional revenue on an annual basis.
Ball State economist Michael Hicks says he doesn't see the additional sales tax impacting online purchases made by Hoosiers.
For most consumers who are shopping, it's not the price, it's not the sales tax exemption that matters. It's the fact that it could actually be cheaper.
There's no word how soon Indiana's online sales tax law could go into effect. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Service dogs have become an increasingly popular way for people to help treat anxiety and other mental illnesses despite a lack of extensive research. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Sophia Salaby reports, a new study from Purdue University shows veterans with PTSD may benefit from the use of service dogs.
The study was the first of its kind to use physiological signs to look at the effects of service dogs on veterans with PTSD. Service dogs are meant to aid in the treatment of anxiety and provide veterans with PTSD a companion for stressful situations. Researchers tested the body stress response of veterans both with and without service dogs. Those with service dogs displayed levels much closer to what a healthy adult without PTSD would experience. Maggie O'Hare was the lead researcher with the project. She characterizes the findings in the study as an exciting first step to better understanding how service dogs can help people.
You know, we're not concluding anything wild at this stage, but it's really interesting to see that you can actually measure a physiological difference in a person who lives with a service dog.
A more comprehensive study is already underway by the same researchers with the National Institutes of Health. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Sophia Salaby.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. For Indiana cities, having a good relationship with railroad companies can help generate a lot of business. But trains can also clog cities, making drivers wait at blocked road crossings. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Charlotte Tuckle reports, mayors have begun to fight freight railroads who say they have too much power and not enough accountability.
Right now, we have a string to battle a giant.
That's Frankfort Mayor Chris McBarnes driving over a railroad crossing he says is frequently blocked by stopped trains. According to a state law, local governments have the authority to fine a railroad company if a crossing is blocked for more than 10 minutes. So McBarnes has begun urging residents to call the police, who've so far written 3 tickets. Problem is, the fines max out at $500 apiece. That's about 1/1,000,000th of the profits CSX made in the fourth quarter of 2017 alone, a financial slap on the wrist. McBarnes says he's just trying to get the railroad's attention.
What we're also calling is we're calling upon our state legislators to put a law, a stiffer law into place with teeth behind it that gives local communities the ability to go to battle with these people if we need to.
There's already a case before the Indiana State Supreme Court concerning blocked crossings. The Norfolk Southern Railway Company argues the existing state statute is preempted by a federal law, the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act, which centralizes regulation at the federal level. The court has yet to rule on the case. Meanwhile, residents of many Indiana communities must find alternate routes around stopped trains.
I might sit here for another 15 minutes, maybe. If it's still not moving, then I'll go around or just figure out something else to do.
Charles Hart works in Crawfordsville and was on his way to the gas station after work when a train stopped and blocked an intersection along his route. He says he used to be stopped 3 or 4 times a week.
This one doesn't bother me as much because this is a side street, but a lot of times they block down at the... Yeah, they block 3 highways, basically, when they stop downtown.
Those stoppages caused traffic to become so congested that Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton set up a camera at the intersection that live streams to his office.
Right now, it's pretty calm, other than what they're doing on the south side, which is a problem, but it's not the catastrophe that when they block down here. So it runs in cycles.
But that's not the only problem. Driving around Crawfordsville, Barton says highway rail crossings are also in disrepair.
Look at this crossing. This is a state highway. And you can see the plates are partially gone. I mean, if you hit that on a motorcycle, you're going to be in trouble. Very dangerous.
The mayors say the state isn't doing enough and the railroads are bullies. The freight companies contest the fines, which keeps crossings blocked and in disrepair. Two problems local government doesn't have the money to fix. The railroad companies, on the other hand, claim any more regulation would hurt business for everyone. The Indiana Department of Transportation's response is the Local Trax program. That's TRAX, by the way. It's a matching grant program written into last year's multi-billion dollar highway tax bill, which gives NDOT money to front up to 80% of the cost of improving safety at a highway rail intersection. NDOT spokesman Scott Manning says it's the first step of a long-term solution to reduce the number of problematic at-grade crossings around the state.
There's opportunity for the state, local government, and host railroads to all have skin in the game, to all have a vested interest We think that'll help maximize the impact.
The other 20% of the funding would come from local governments. Host railroads have the option to partner with municipalities to cover that cost. CSX and Norfolk Southern officials both declined a taped interview for this story. In an emailed statement, CSX says it supports the local tracks program. And as for the blocked crossings, the company says it has experienced what it calls operational challenges in Crawfordsville and has since made changes to reduce the number of incidents. Company officials say they apologize to residents and are communicating with local leaders about the problem. In Norfolk Southern's statement, the company says its government relations office in Indianapolis hasn't heard any concerns from Frankfurt, but is motivated to keep the trains moving for business reasons. It calls long delays highly unusual and asks residents, who it says should be able to get around trains at nearby crossings, to keep in mind that those trains provide jobs and tax revenue. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Charlotte Tuggle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An increasing number of Indiana police and fire departments are using drone technology to help navigate emergency situations. It's part of a growing national trend. According to the Center for the Study of the Drone at Bard College, the number of public safety agencies with drones has increased more than 80% in the past year. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports, their success has other industries looking to drones for solutions.
People expect to hear sirens when police respond to an emergency, but there's another sound Noble County residents are growing used to. That powerful whirring sound is coming from one of the Noble County Sheriff's Department's two drones. It's not much larger than a backpack, but it can travel hundreds of feet in the air and give police a perspective they didn't have before.
I can't overstate how much value and how much of a resource multiplier it has been for us.
That's Shafter Baker, the chief pilot for the department. He says they didn't have access to an aircraft of their own before buying the drones in 2016. It would cost nearly $400 an hour to hire a helicopter to aid in an investigation. But the department can operate a drone for about $20 an hour. Deputy Brandon Cordes says it's not just cheaper, but more efficient.
There's no standing by and waiting for the state police to be contacted to bring a helicopter out.
The drone operators use a controller outfitted with a large display screen, which allows them to see what the drone is seeing. The bird's eye view is useful for everything from analyzing a crash site to finding a missing person. Cordes says he realized the power of the small devices the first time he went out on a call with one. A child got off a school bus but never came home.
So we went out and flew around the area. We cleared probably 6 square miles in an hour.
But some Hoosiers worry about police and fire departments using drones. That's something Captain Michael Pruitt with the Wayne Township Fire Department says he experienced firsthand when the department announced it was starting a drone program.
There was a lot of uproar over privacy issues with the drones.
State law dictates how emergency responders can fly drones. Police and fire investigators have to obtain a search warrant in order to use them, unless it's an emergency situation. And Pruitt says most of the calls his department responds to are emergencies.
In the last 3 years, we've covered just about everything possible with the drones. We've conducted search and rescue operations like went on with the incident involving the young boy in Columbus, missing kayaker in Bartholomew County.
Pruitt says he expects drones will eventually become a tool every fire department has. And Indiana State University sees potential far beyond emergency responders. It started the state's first bachelor's degree in unmanned systems a few years ago. Sam Morgan is an instructor for the program.
We create individuals that can go from I call it the landscaper model, where they have a truck and a drone and they'll take whatever job they can get.
Students learn how to build and repair the drones. Then they get hands-on experience flying them in a variety of missions.
We've got a couple students working for a roofing company that has started to use drones with software that'll automatically detect hail damage.
Morgan says there's no shortage of jobs for students, and he expects the demand to only increase as more public sector companies turn to drones to do things they otherwise can't. For the Noble County Sheriff's Department, it's a no-brainer. The drones are cheaper, faster, and help keep officers out of harm's way. Baker says he only has one complaint.
I wish we would have had the drones a lot sooner than we actually have them.
He regularly fields calls from other emergency responders who are looking for guidance in starting their own drone programs. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The Republican Party winner of the May 8th primary for the Lake County Council 7th District seat, Christian Jurgensen, talked with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson after Friday's recount. Jurgensen is currently president of the St. John Town Council, and he is an attorney by trade. Jurgensen was running against incumbent Eldon Strong for the district seat. When asked about his opponent's concession of the race, he said that was a positive.
Well, I'm happy that it actually occurred. I asked, and I had spoken to him on Friday after we had completed the paper count, which took all day. One of the recount commissioners, Mr. Oliver, who is the chief mechanic for the election commission, had stated to all of us that he's been through five recounts. And of those five recounts, there's never, ever been a change in the electronic vote. So my point was, hey, you know, let's get through the counting of the absentee ballots and reconsider. We're both part of the same party. I mean, it's a primary. We're both Republicans. You know, let's try to heal and move forward. But at that time, he refused. So we were prepared to go today, and I heard last night about 9:30.
Sunday night?
Sunday night.
So it was a hard-fought race because you guys were, like, way close, right?
Well, I mean, two-vote margin. It only gets closer if there's only one.
Right. What do you want to do if you're elected?
What do I want to do? Well, certainly I want to be fiscally conservative, but what I want to do is make sure that our tax money in South County is brought back down here, and the focus is on our infrastructure. So we still have gravel roads in South County. That's unacceptable.
And are you running opposed? Is there a Democrat running against you?
Currently there is not. However, the Democratic chairman, Mr. Weezer, has until June 30th to slate somebody if he so chooses. But no, nobody ran in the actual race.
So what are you going to do if somebody runs against you?
Well, I'll work just as hard as I did against Eldon Strong. I ran a great campaign. I had great people. We worked tirelessly from December onward. And, you know, what I can say is, you know, we as Republicans have to come back together. And if there is somebody slated on the Democratic Party against us, you know, we have to unite and make sure that South County remains a bastion of Republican and conservative ideals. And that's what I'm looking to do.
Why did you get involved in politics, or what got you interested?
Well, like I said, I'm president of the town council in St. John. I've always had an interest in politics. Certainly, I've been an attorney for 20 years, but I always thought that it was a better use of my education, my experience, my legal background, to serve in a political arena rather than, you know, merely practicing law. I just feel that it's a more rewarding and endeavor and something that I was well suited to do. It's certainly not for the money.
Yeah, I don't know how much you guys make, so I couldn't say, but I wouldn't think that it'd be
very little. Very, very little.
Is it? You have any other aspirations, like to run for higher office later on down the line?
Absolutely. I see this as is something that I can do until, you know, I've achieved the goals that I possibly can for South County. I intend to stay in South County, certainly not going to leave, and in whatever capacity that I can serve here in South County, I plan to do so, whether it be in the Senate, in the House, either one. But I do see myself, of course, going to Indianapolis and serving us all there. And I think this is a great road to do that, from the local level here in St. John to the county level to Indianapolis. It makes sense. I think it's a good progression of skills. And, yeah, I certainly can see myself doing that.
Okay. Would you ever run for governor?
I have to tell you that I haven't really thought about governor. You know, that's certainly some time away. I'm relatively young in my political career. I think Eric Holcomb, I consider him a great friend, and I think he's doing a fantastic job. So, I mean, I couldn't necessarily tell you one way or another, but I'm certainly happy with Eric Holcomb, and he's a great influence on me. So I don't know. I guess I leave that to speculation.
Anything else you want to say about the situation with Mr. Strong?
You know, I think it's time for a change for South County. I think it's time for us to progress forward. I think that it goes to show that Mr. Strong has been in that office for 7 years, I believe. He was caucused in, and then he ran again. I believe it was unopposed. And half the people came out and said it was time for a change. Now, again, we're both Republicans. We have different ways of looking at things. Certainly, I took issue with several of the decisions that Mr. Strong made along the road. And I believe that those half of those people who voted for me agree with my way of thinking. And it was, you know, we need to progress forward in a different way. And we need new ideas, and we need some fresh thinking. The same kind of thing that I brought to the council in St. John. We've certainly prospered here, and I think we have many good programs, and that's what we need. And I think a lot of people are seeing the need for fresh thinking, fresh ideas, new thoughts. So that's really all I have to say about that.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time, and thanks a lot for the interview.
Absolutely. Thank you for calling. I appreciate the interest. And you know what? I guess there is one last thing I'd like to say.
Sure.
Because this is very, very important. Two great, great things came out of this election. One is that I won by two votes. So that's very significant because it's a non-presidential election year, and it goes to show that every single vote counts. Everybody's vote matters. So it should inspire people to continue to come out to vote and to make a difference, because everybody can make a difference. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, with regard to the election process itself, I believe that the recount statute is archaic. I believe it was based on a system when everybody used paper voting rather than electronic, like we do here now in Lake County, mm-hmm. which eliminates human error, eliminates the fraud. And I would say that entire statute needs to be revamped to reflect the change in technology that's occurred. And what this election did for us is vindicate our election system here in Lake County, the people who work at the Election Commission, and all of the poll workers in all of the precincts. I mean, it truly vindicates their hard work and their attention to detail. What we have is a fantastic system here, and this has just gone to show that, again, we've been able to uphold exactly what it is that we do here with the count and with the integrity of the system. So I'm certainly happy that everybody got a chance to see that we definitely know what we're doing here in Lake County now with regard to elections, and people can be 100% confident that their vote counts and it's counted correctly. Again, two great things that came out of this election.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Sure. My pleasure.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Jesse Brown Veterans Administration Medical Director Mark McGill on veterans suicide prevention.
Thanks for joining us, Mark McGill, here on Regionally Speaking.
It's nice to be here.
Well, we know that the 20 challenge is something that is a personal goal that you have set in taking over as Executive Director of the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago. And the 20 challenge has a very significant goal in its own right here because of a very serious problem that not only the VA, but veterans all across the country face these days. First, if you will, tell us a little bit more about the 20 challenge and about the major concern that you personally have, as well as everybody in the VA healthcare system has, about the rate of veteran suicides in our country.
Yes, thank you. So 20, unfortunately, is the number that nationally, every day, 20 of our heroes successfully take their lives. And of the 20, only 6 of those veterans have ever received VA services. And that's really relevant, because what that means, the other 14, if they would have known about some of the resources that we have at VA, and I'll talk about those later if I can, we might have been able to prevent that, because my docs tell me that suicide is preventable. And I will tell you, our goal is to, whatever we can do, get that 20 down to 0. I will tell you, I'm not clinical. I will tell you that this is a very complicated issue, and a lot of people don't understand. And I myself don't understand all the variables, that would lead someone, has made so many contributions to feel such a hopelessness that they would take their lives. But we came up with the 20 challenge, and obviously 20 is the relevant figure here. And what I like to do, and if you can visualize right now, I'm holding up my cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get in front of a audience. I'll say, how many folks out there have one of these? And, of course, everyone will raise their hands. You know, they'll have their cell phones. Most of the time, they're holding on to them. And so I'll talk a little bit about the 20 figure and the 14 and the 6 that I mentioned. But then I'll say, okay, here's what I want you to do. Over the next 20 days, I want you to first take down a contact, and that contact is the Veterans Crisis Line. It's 800-273-8255. Again, that's 800-273-8255. And what I'll challenge the audience to do is put that contact in their phone, and then over the next 20 days, to send that contact out to 20 more people and then ask them to do the same. And what I usually do is I'll tell a little bit about what that number is and what the crisis line is. It's actually, a lot of people think it's just for veterans. No, it's not. It's for you and I. If we're concerned about a veteran, whether that's a family, a friend, a neighbor, or even a complete stranger, if we see warning signs and think that veteran needs help, we can call that crisis line, and the folks there, and there's actually three lines now that are national that link into that same number, and they will ensure that veteran gets help.
I also know, too, that there's a text message number that you can also put in, too, that if you happen to have that available, too.
Yes, that's true as well, and you can press 1 after you do that number.
The number I have here is 838-255, and that'll give you the same opportunity to get the same kind of help 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. How many people are working with you folks at the crisis hotline in the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center?
Well, since I've been here, we've actually doubled that number of staff, and now we have 4 staff on board, and actually we're in the process of hiring 2 more. That's for not only our medical center, but our other 4 sites of care that make up the Jesse Brown Veterans Healthcare System.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about these people who are manning the telephones and the text messages to help people out.
So the national people, of course, are 24/7 on the crisis line, and that's the number that we talked about, and then the text that they'd respond to as well. Our local folks, the suicide prevention coordinators, they're mental health professionals, and they are trained to look for warning signs, whether that's hearing from someone that calls or whether it's hearing from the veteran themselves. But some warning signs, won't read all of them, but some might be you notice hopelessness. Or someone that's acting recklessly or engaged in behaviors that normally they would not engage in.
Right.
Some other things would be withdrawing from friends or family or society, or anxiety, agitation, change in diet, and then things like saying things like, well, I feel like a burden. And so our professionals, they look for signs like that, and then we actually have a suicide risk assessment that we can do, and then depending on the particular issues that they see, can then dictate how we can come up with the best treatment plan to then again hopefully prevent that veteran from having any harm to themselves. And what we do find, by the way, is we'll get that veteran into other things, and we'll find other variables that we can help. If I could talk about two real quickly.
Certainly, run ahead.
So these are variables that actually contribute to the incidence of suicide, but chronic pain. So chronic pain, for example, we have so many different treatments, both traditional but non-traditional things that have really proven outcome, like acupuncture, for example, or massage, or things like that, that we work with our veterans, and we have what's called a pain university that we can get our veterans in, and we can help with management of that chronic pain.
Let me ask you, too, about on the same topic here, too. Are we finding that these ways to help veterans deal with their pain problems that they may have, can they be certainly linked in trying to help deal with the opioid crisis as well?
Absolutely. In fact, that's the second thing I was going to mention. Opioid use definitely is a contributing factor. So we have a variety of substance and addiction treatment therapy programs here, and again, we can just integrate that veteran in with one or more of those programs to definitely get them help.
From what's been passed along to you from your doctors and from other people who work on the veterans crisis line, have there been any success stories to be able to tell that you've been able to get help for people that that might have been just another statistic?
I tell you what, and this is why this is so personal to me. I've talked to several veterans that have told me directly, and some of these are guys I know. You know, I walk down our halls every day and I talk to my veterans. Some are just folks that might have seen my picture or have seen me in the halls, and, you know, are you the director? They'll come up and they'll tell me. And again, I've had this happen so many times about how, you know, I got to tell you, VA has saved my life. And that, I got to tell you, is pretty powerful. When you actually have someone come up to you and say, you know, I wouldn't be here if it wouldn't have been for the services that you guys provide. I take that very seriously and very personal, and that's why we just have we're putting a lot of resources into whatever we can locally here in the Chicago market to just eliminate this incidence of veteran suicide.
Let's repeat that number again for the crisis Veterans Crisis Line, which is 800-273-8255, and you press 1, and then you'll get to talk to somebody on the other end of the line to get some questions answered and have a chance to chat online and get some other issues as well dealt with if you have any that are related to a concern about a veteran, a loved one's concern about a veteran, a veteran's own concern about himself, or maybe a friend or a buddy maybe from the service that they've learned that is having problems that may be leading to suicide, and a way to help prevent another suicide from happening here. Mark, we go, while we have you with us on the program today, let's ask, we've had before a recent series of town hall meetings when you first came to become the executive director at the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center in Chicago. Are there any more plans for any more town hall meetings here in Northwest Indiana?
Absolutely, and we will average once a quarter to not just Indiana, but all of the other sites of care. Just had a great town hall at the medical center yesterday, and I'll have to tell you, had one 2 weeks ago at our Auburn Gresham Clinic, but mm-hmm. The number one thing that our veterans right now want to know is VA going to be there for my care?
Right.
And I will tell you, as director of Jesse Brown Veterans Healthcare System, yes, we are.
Well, that sounds like a topic for another day in itself right there, and we definitely plan to have you back on to be able to pick up some of these topics here, and we'll have some other folks, the experts from the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center, to talk on other issues, too, that are any related to, in some way or another, to the suicide problem here in not only Northwest Indiana, the Chicago market, but all across the country. Mark McGill is the executive director of the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center, based in Chicago. And, of course, under the sphere of the Jesse Brown facility, we have, of course, the outpatient clinics in locations like the one in Crown Point. Mark, thank you for being with us today, and we will definitely have you back on to talk about some more issues soon.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.